The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Ina Garten is not only a household name, she is beloved. With the help of her Food Network program, Barefoot Contessa, not to mention all those viral videos, Garten has 14 million cookbooks in print. 14 million. Her success doesn't really come, though, from pioneering recipes or being in the foodie avant-garde. It's got more to do with being a confiding, authentic, warm personality that tells you that you, too, can make coq au vin or a roast tenderloin, anything. Just follow the recipe. You can do it. Ina's approach to food is classic and accessible. And her latest book, Go-To Dinners, is a bestseller, as usual. Now, my wife and I have known Ina and her husband, Jeffrey Garten, the economist and chief Ina appreciator, for a good while now. And I can tell you, hand to heart, that the person you see on TV is the same one you get in person. Funny, unpretentious, a smart businesswoman, and a master of every variety of chicken known to the history of heated poultry. She's the real deal. Now, I have to start out by telling you the last time I had a famous cook on the show, I may have told you this, it was Jacques Pepin. And on the radio, with my laptop in the kitchen, I made crepes with him. And with my wife Esther laughing at me in the corner of the kitchen. So we're not gonna cook. We're just gonna talk.
We're not cooking. Okay. We'll cook in person. How's that?
Exactly. I'd love to do that.
Now, nothing worse than having your wife laughing at you.
It's a daily.
Your very, very smart wife laughing at you.
An hourly occurrence. Now, you write in the preface of this book, early in the book, you said that when you were growing up, you had dreaded dinner time. Why was it dreaded? Was the food so terrible? What was your, was it your mom that was making dinner?
My mother was making dinner. Mm-hmm. My father was a ear surgeon. And my mother was very, I think now I might say that she would be diagnosed with Asperger's, didn't have relationships, and she had no interest in food. So she would get dinner on the table, but there was no joy in it.
What was dinner on the table? What was it?
I had broiled chicken, canned peas. She was a dietitian by training, mm-hmm. and didn't believe in carbohydrates. So we never had bread or potatoes or polenta or anything absolutely delicious. I mean, we didn't even have frozen vegetables. We had canned vegetables. I particularly remember Harvard beets, one of my least favorite things in the world. And no child likes Harvard beets. You might develop a flavor for it, a taste for it afterwards, but not when you're 10.
And it sounds like dinner was not a joyful time.
It wasn't a joyful time. And my parents, particularly my father, was very stern taskmaster and would grill us about whatever was in school. He would criticize us. So when dinner was over, I had a nice knot in my stomach. And they would always want me to eat faster. So they would say, every time your brother takes a bite, you take a bite.
Oh, my God.
And I'd be like, oh, I just can't.
When is the first time you picked up a frying pan in earnest? It wasn't just when you got married later on.
100% was when I got married. I was never allowed in the kitchen. So my mother never taught me how to do anything. And she didn't see any joy in it. She felt that my job was to study and it was her job to make dinner. And I think she wasn't comfortable with me being in the same room with her. So she would always say, you go study. And so I was in my room my whole childhood. And I think I was pretty lonely. I think that's why now cooking for friends and Jeffrey and doing the show, Be My Guest, where I'm connecting with people, is so satisfying.
In other words, you like to cook with people around, not by your lonesome in the kitchen.
I prefer to cook by myself.
You do?
And I do. Cooking's hard for me. I mean, I do it a lot, but it's really hard. And I just love having the space to concentrate on what I'm doing, so I make sure it comes out well. Cooking's hard. I mean, when you go to the butcher and you order a chicken, it's a different size every time. Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of chicken. I mean, you know, some chickens, you know, they're allowed to add water to it. You have no idea what you're going to get. So it's, I mean, just the simplest thing is chicken can be complicated. I do find it hard. I really, I'm not confident that it's going to come out well. And I have to say, I'm surprised when it does. I think.
Do you remember
maybe I have high standards.
Do you remember the first time you made a dinner in earnest for you and Jeffrey?
Well, probably as soon as we got married, because it wasn't like we had the money to go out for dinner. So when we were engaged, before we got married, I remember going out and buying Craig Claiborne's the New York Times cookbook. Mm-hmm. And I went to, what was it called? It's a store like, I think it was called Caldor. Mm-hmm. And I bought an entire set of kitchen equipment. And I just was really excited about being able to cook. But I remember within the first month, I made a challah. And I remember thinking, wow, that's what you're going to start with? But I did. I really love things that challenge me, that I think I can't do, and then make them and show myself that I can do them.
I get the feeling, and this is far from your first book. You've had many books before this, but Go To Dinners is a book in a way made for Ina Garten back then. In other words, these are in some ways the least intimidating recipes you could imagine. You're almost telling the reader, you know, darling, I know you think you can't do anything, but even you can do this.
It actually does come full circle, doesn't it? Because once I've learned how to cook, and then, of course, I got Mastering the Art of French Cooking, both volumes, and worked my way through those. So I learned the French techniques from Julia Child. And I really believe in simplifying things. But what happened in the pandemic is we were also completely stressed. We didn't know what we could do, what we couldn't do. I was making a recipe every day for Instagram so people could figure out what to do with those white beans that they had in their pantry.
3,000 pounds of white beans.
Exactly. So many white beans and whatever they had. I was making recipes for my cookbook, for this book. And I was cooking lunch and dinner for Jeffrey and me every single day. And by sometime around May or June, I was like in bed with the covers up over my head. And I thought, I really need to simplify. So it is true that I came full circle, but for a different reason.
Now, I've admitted this to you before, but I'm now admitting it to everybody who's listening. To relax, I don't cook. I watch cooking videos. I watch you. I watch Jacques Pepin. I watch this Szechuan guy who's going 300 miles an hour making incredible food, but I can't cook. Hold my hand and tell me what I need to know initially. If I'm having four people over, six people, whatever it is, what do I need to know? What do I not need to be nervous about? And what would you recommend I start with?
I think there's one thing everybody should know how to do, which is a roast chicken. Mm-hmm. And I do it in all different forms. I do it with potatoes and fennel. I do it in this book, I have a spring roast chicken, or roast chicken with spring vegetables, with things like asparagus. You can put almost any kind of vegetable in a roasting pan and a chicken on top of it and put it in the oven. It's the easiest thing in the world, and the only thing you have to do is make sure you don't overcook the chicken. People get really nervous.
So you think this is the easiest thing? This is the point of entry?
Any kind of roast chicken, or the chicken in a pot, which is just as easy as can be. You put it in a big pot with chicken stock and vegetables, and then you add saffron to give it a little heat, and then orzo, and you've got a whole dinner all in one pot.
Now, I have to ask you, I'm lucky enough to know Jeffrey, but I think for most people who watch you, they see Jeffrey at the end of your show, and he'll be saying something like, this is the best soup I've ever had, or this chicken's unbelievable, or something like that. And you think to yourself, he can't possibly be this nice and this brilliant at the same time.
He's just so appreciative And I think it's one of the reasons why I love to cook, because if you cook for somebody who doesn't appreciate it, there's no satisfaction in it. I made him, one day I made him a cup of tea, and he said, "Oh, this is the best tea I've ever had." And I was like, "Jeffrey, it's a cup of hot water and a tea bag." It was a particularly good tea, but I mean, still, he nothing goes by him. He really appreciates it, which I love.
Now, you ran a store, you owned a store from 1978 to 1996, a long time, the Barefoot Contessa. And why did that hit the way it hit out in the Hamptons? It was an incredible success.
I thought of it as a party. When you walked in the door, I wanted all of your senses engaged. I wanted you to smell something wonderful. I wanted you to see a wonderful display of produce, or I wanted to hear great music, but it was old fashioned, like Tony Bennett and Frank Sinatra, or whatever was fun to listen to. There were samples of things all over the store so you could taste things. And people would just come in just because it was fun. And I thought, if they're going to come because it's fun, they'll always come when they're hungry. Mm. And I think that's what worked. It wasn't really about the food. It was about the feeling of being in the store.
It seems impossible to imagine, but there was a time, Ina, that you were not that you were not as famous as you are now. You started publishing these cookbooks, and you were hesitant about doing a television show. I mean, you got offers, I think, more than once before you decided to go forward with it. What was your hesitation?
I didn't think anybody would want to watch me cook on TV, actually. Food Network kindly made me an offer, and I kept saying no, and they kept coming back. And there was someone there, Eileen Opetut, who just kept saying, make me a better offer. And I kept saying to her, no, I just don't want to do this. And she just kept coming back. And finally, I had heard about a show that somebody said was a really good cooking show. And it was Nigella Lawson's show.
Right.
And unbeknownst to me, they went to London, found her producer, told me that they were coming to East Hampton like in 2 weeks. And I was like, whoa, I said I wasn't going to do this. And and Eileen said, just do, 13 shows, thinking like, that, how hard could that be? and they arrived on my doorstep, and I thought, okay, let's see what we can do. And, one of the things I think about in life is you got to jump in the pond.
Right.
You say no to things without really understanding. Like I said no to Instagram before I understood what it was. And I kept saying no about TV. I was just like, I love writing cookbooks. I want to keep doing that. And I can't imagine being on TV.
It always seemed to me that the most successful ones, there was some character involved. No, Julia Child was a big character. She had personality traits that we could easily list. Graham Kerr did, all kinds of people who've done it. How do you think about that in terms of the personality you put out there? Because I have to say, being lucky enough to know you, it seems like one and the same person.
I am the same person you see on TV. I found a coach who would teach me how to be on TV. And I have no idea why I knew this, but after one session with her, I thought, that's just awful. Nothing she said made sense to me. And I thought, I just need to be myself on TV.
Right.
It's the only thing that works. And I don't know why I knew that. I just knew it.
I have to say, though, I'm watching you cook, and there's a move that you do. All of a sudden, a stick and a half of butter goes into the pan. And you look up, both with mischief in your eyes and a little guiltily, and say, yeah, but it makes a lot of brownies. Okay. Go ahead.
Do you know what I believe? I think we should eat real food.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's delicious, it's worth cooking for. My favorite expression is, if you eat low-fat diet, it's not that you live longer. It just seems longer. Isn't that true?
Now, we have some questions sent by email to you. This comes from Julie Wilson and Maureen Tipping in Comer, Northern Ireland. And this question is from my neighbor Maureen and me, Julie. We're tuning in from Comer, which is a small village just outside of Belfast. During COVID, our neighborhood came together into a really lovely, supportive, and fun community. We went from being neighbors to being friends. This Christmas, we would like to co-host a party for our street. Our village is famous for potatoes, so we're really keen to know if Ina has any ideas on how to transform the humble spud into a delicious party food hors d'oeuvre.
A potato hors d'oeuvre is interesting.
And keep in mind, you're giving potato tips to Ireland. That's a tall order.
Exactly. That's really daunting. Yes. You know what I would do is I'd make potato latkes. I think that would be great.
Wow. And you have a great recipe for that, I should say.
I do. And what you can do is you can prepare them in advance, put them on a sheet pan and reheat them in the oven, warm them in the oven.
Sounds delish.
From is that a good one?
From Alex Lewin in Berkeley, California. Dear Ms. Garten, about 10 years ago, I read a short story in Harper's about which I remember nothing, not the title, the author, or the plot, except for a scene in which a character fishes a bay leaf out of a bowl of soup and flicks it away, and he tells his dining companion, bay leaves are BS. Ever since then, I've been nagged by the question, are bay leaves BS? Whenever I put them in anything, I can't tell what effect they have. Am I using them wrong? Also, is it true that they should be kept in the freezer?
Okay, I really don't know the answer to this, and I will say that I always also wonder whether a bay leaf makes a difference. And there are a couple of things that I use bay leaves in, and I've always wanted to make them without the bay leaves to see if it made a difference, and I never have. So I'm not sure.
Can I just say this is called making news? Ina Garten calls bullshit on bay leaves. I'm with that. Now, these are questions from New Yorker Instagram. What to make for two people while still making it feel like a holiday and a special meal? This is from Teresa Nobry.
You know what's really great is roast pork loins, because they're very small, and you can marinate them and roast them really simply, serve them with like a potato and apple and fennel puree and some shaved Brussels sprouts. It'd be a great holiday meal, and it's not like cooking a whole ham.
I have a very important question to ask. When did Brussels sprouts go from being, as in my childhood, disgusting to in...
I happen to know.
Into my adulthood, it's like, I can't wait to get more Brussels sprouts. What happened?
What happened was, and I actually started this at the store in the 80s. Yeah. I started roasting Brussels sprouts instead of boiling them. And they were so good because they're like crispy and they're more like French fries. They're fantastic. So then I thought, well, if you can roast Brussels sprouts, maybe you can roast butternut squash. So we started roasting butternut squash and string beans. And I mean, we roasted everything. And the best part is it's the easiest thing in the world. You put whatever vegetable it is on a sheet pan, olive oil, salt and pepper, and into the oven.
So on asparagus too, you're pro roasting rather than steaming or boiling.
100%. I think it brings out the flavor, it caramelizes the sugars in it, and it's much more delicious.
Now, here's a fantastic question from someone named Hampton's Video. I don't think that's the name, but here we go. Do you ever use a microwave?
I do. I use it for every day, actually, to make oatmeal in the morning. It's a perfect thing to do. I'll use it if I'm going to melt butter. I'll use it to prep things. I mean, not a lot. It's not like I'm cooking in there. But every morning I use it for my oatmeal. Good Irish oatmeal.
Perfect. Now, this is not exactly a food question. How many scarves do you own? You always have one on. Sue Palmer.
A lot. I have drawers and drawers of scarves. She's absolutely right. I have them everywhere. I just love having a scarf around my neck. I just think it feels good. David, I was just thinking to myself, can we just do this again tomorrow?
We can do it all day.
So much fun.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ina Garten, thank you so much.
So much fun to talk to you, as always, David.
Thank you. Ina Garten's most recent book is called Go To Dinners, and her latest show, Be My Guest with Ina Garten, is in its second season. Oh, and one note from the fact-checking department to Alex Lewin, who asked about bay leaves. The short story you read in Harper's was by Laurie Moore, and it's called Subject to Search in 2014. The offending bay leaf was in a dish of couscous, but the fact-checker did not settle the crucial question of whether or not bay leaves are BS. Thanks for writing in, Alex. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. You've probably never heard the name Robin Miles, but there's a good chance you've heard her, and maybe at some length.
Stop your nonsense, Wilbur,
said the oldest sheep.
If you have a new friend here, you are probably disturbing his rest. And the quickest way to spoil a friendship is to wake somebody up in the morning before he's ready. How can you be sure your friend is an early riser?
Robin Miles is an actor who's appeared in over 400 audiobooks. 400, in all sorts of genres. From E.B. White's classic Charlotte's Web to Isabel Wilkerson's Caste, which is a deep analysis of race in America. Audiobooks are a booming segment of the publishing industry, and Miles has cultivated that as a specialty. She describes herself as a vocal chameleon, skilled at imitating and playing with accents for different characters, even inventing new accents. Daniel Gross, who's an editor at The New Yorker, has been writing about Robin Miles, and they've gotten pretty deep into the craft of reading a book out loud.
Robin records a lot of her books in her closet, and it's a little trapezoidal closet, which is smaller than like a shower stall. Robin has impeccable posture. She has a ballet instructor's posture. And she has these sharp cheekbones. And I remember that she took her shoes off before she walked into the studio. And even when I went to a professional recording studio with her, she took off her rain boots and then she walked into the studio. She always records barefoot. Teach me one of your warm-ups. I want to try it out.
Okay.
We're in front of a microphone now, so.
Basically, starting with your middle range and then going down with a kind of a nasally Y sound. So, and then coming forward, and I do an in breath. Till I get to that buzzy spot where you hear it going in and out. It means the sound is popping in and out of different sinus chambers, loosening everything up in there.
I feel like I'm at the beginning of a classical concert and everybody's tuning their instruments.
Yes, that's sometimes how I feel too.
Yeah.
Definitely.
You trained as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
You could have worked in TV, film, Broadway. You did
yeah.
work in some of these areas.
Mm-hmm. I have.
Why narration?
Oh, wow. Well, all right, I'm going to tell you the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good is telling a story fully, all of it, from all the aspects of it, and creating the kind of intimacy between you and your listener is so satisfying. Being in a great play means you have to have the money and the other actors and a script and a director. This is just me and my book. And I love that. Secondly, it's Bottom's dream from A Midsummer Night's Dream. Let me play the lion's part too. And, you know, I shall play Thisbe in a monstrous small voice. I love to play all those different characters. Yeah. I'm a vocal chameleon, at least that's what I've been called, and I loved it. I was like, okay, I'll take that. I feel like a vocal chameleon sometimes, and transforming myself into those things and trying to find a truthful way to do that. There's nothing else like it, really. I get to exercise every muscle in my body and my mind, too. So why? This. Now, the practical, the ugly, is when I got out of drama school. Man, I think I got out in 94. I don't remember exactly when this began, but there was a stretch where Hollywood or television did not create one black or minority character in the television lineup for the new season. And I had a powerful agent at the time. There was almost nothing for me to go out for.
That was the world you graduated into.
Into. And it's timing, you know, sometimes somebody else comes out and it's like, whoa, they're in the Shonda Rhimes period. That's fabulous. I've been waiting for the Shonda Rhimes period, you know, to come, where we have these writers creating opportunities. And we have a population of people in the United States who are beginning to see, they're beginning to expand their notion of who can be American. Because I do think that's really what's at the base of it. You know, you have an Asian actor, you have a black actor, you've got Middle Eastern actor. Why can't they just play an American? But we don't have, during that period especially, we didn't have access to those roles. So you had to wait for something to match your ethnicity.
And not just your ethnicity, but the ethnicity that was perceived when a person saw you.
Right.
So graduating into that world.
And I thought, well, let me park myself here. Let me hang out over here. But I got so much from doing the books. And, you know, then I realized, of course, you know, it was an after job, now SAG-AFTRA, but I had health insurance.
That's always what does it, right?
And it was my second book, Cane River, by Lolita Tatamy. Seven generations, I believe, might be six, of family members in slavery in Louisiana. And the creating of that family line, mostly through rape. I mean, that is what it is in this book. But the slave owners were French. And so a lot of the men are coming literally from France. So that first generation, all those men, now cease, they all have a very crisp French accent. And then they have their children. And what I did was I started to create what would be a Creole dialect, because it doesn't start out that way. And then each generation start to have a little more that going on, you know, like the rhythm and the vowel sounds. And I thought, nobody's ever going to notice. And then the review came out, and I thought, wow, people really listen. The reviewer was really listening. And
wow. So you were basically inventing a language or a dialect, because it was in that middle space between
French. Yeah, it was kind of liminal.
Accent.
Yeah. And I do that now a lot in fantasy and in sci-fi. I call them mashups. It's a Jamaican term, it's a mashitop. I'll have a character, let's say, that's from a dominant race in the universe, or that has some sort of power. And I'll say, all right, you know, German and Nigerian. Nigeria is a power on that continent, and Germany is a power on that continent. And I'll take the German consonant sounds or vowel sounds, and I'll mash it up with the rhythm pattern of somebody who might come from Nigeria.
Wow.
So that it doesn't sound exactly like one of those things. And it's so you can't just say, well, it's German, but it's not. There's something else in there.
How do you keep it straight so that when you return to that character 10 pages later, you're in the same voice and not in some other voice?
Oh, that took me a while to really, I think, nail. What I do is I start reading the book and I'll get about 80 pages in and stop. And I'm underlining and highlighting any characteristics about a character.
This is when you're reading.
And I'm doing
for
the pre-read. I'm just prepping now. I'm reading the way anybody would read a book, maybe a little bit more slowly. I highlight, underline, and then I stop at about page 80. I take everything and put it into my tracking doc. I want to know how old they are. I want to know if they're tall or short. Do they have a barreled chest? I want to know what they look like. I'm going to put the length of their hair, the color of their hair, that they speak out of the sides of their mouth. Anything big like a lisp or an accent, of course, I'm going to notice and notate. And then I'm looking at what are their reactions. When they're in scenes with other people, are they quick to anger? Are they snarky? Who is this person? And then I have all that written down.
Why is it important to know if they're tall or if they're barrel-chested? How does that figure into your performance of it?
Imagine, okay, I have a character named Fran, and she was in 12 Times Blessed. Wow, I remember that. Fran is described as being, she's like 6'6", 1. She's described as being able to drink a guy under the table. She's the best friend of the protagonist. And I thought, if I were 6'1" and a woman, almost every single person that I have conversations with I'm going to be looking physically down several inches at them. And if my friend is 5'6", I'm literally going to be looking down. So one day I was sort of just reading and I thought, I put my finger on my chin and I went, what? So my face, the plane of my face would always be tilted down. And as soon as I did that, it kind of compressed right there. There's Fran. It kind of compressed my vocal cords. And there's Fran. And she's, she's just like your great kind of like everyday gal. She's got her feet on the ground. No nonsense. I got to haul a mattress up the stairs. I can do that. That's no problem. But it came from the plane of her face would be tilted toward this floor all the time.
It's physical. It's not just auditory. It's actually in the body.
It was in my body. I have used other ways in, like in the book Windy City Blues. It's the story of Chess Records. The two brothers who ran Chess Records are prominent characters. And so in that book, she describes what they sound like. He gets on the phone and he's trying to sell his black artists, right? Because it's a black blues label. And he gets on the phone, and then when he shows up, they're shocked that he's white. So there was something about how he was talking that needed to have a little molasses in it. That's what I call it. And then that came from that nugget.
Wow.
Right?
You don't have to know what it is that makes him sound black.
But they're shocked when he shows up and he's not black. I know how that feels. People are shocked when I show up and I'm not white. I get that. I just did a historic piece, Shana, which is by a writer who wrote all romances, but it takes place in the 1700s. And so I had to have characters that sounded like that. And the jailers, they were all like Cockney characters, right? And they're in the jail and, they're brutalizing other people. And so I had to be able to do that, which means way open throat, glottalizing, glottal shucking a lot. I love playing pirates, in a bottle of rum. How much more fun could an actor ever have playing a pirate?
There's this push in Hollywood and in stage acting to be a lot more thoughtful about casting and, you're less likely now to see a Korean actor playing a Chinese character, a South Asian actor playing a Latina character. The rules seem slightly different in audio, and I wonder what they are from your perspective. How do you think about, do you think of audiobook narration in that same way?
I think about it similarly in that if there's a book with a main character who is from a place, and a lot of the other people in the book are from that same place, it makes sense. It just does, to try and find someone from that culture who narrates. The second part of that, someone who narrates, not just an actor, because it is a different medium. Learning how to approach this material in story form like this is different. And I know as an audiobook director, when I've had celebrities, sometimes you really got to give them more time to make that transition from what they know to this new thing. But you also get books where you have an international cast. And at that point, you need somebody who has a background like I do, who feels comfortable doing, okay, there's a Swedish character, there's an Irish character, there's a Jamaican, there's a this. You're going to need to have somebody who can pull that off.
A vocal chameleon, you said.
Yes, a vocal chameleon? I don't know. I will say, though, I think this idea of authenticity in entertainment, because it's really the broader stroke is film, TV, stage, etc. Authenticity is not just, I don't know how to be clear about this, but we have a population of people here that are from all over the place. And a lot of the marginalized people who have not been allowed to be an American since forever have also been oftentimes barred from even playing themselves. Like they were casting white actors as Latinos since the beginning of time. And white actors in blackface, white actors in yellowface with their eyes taped. I mean, there's that horrible Mickey Rooney cameo.
Yep, that's Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Right. And the actors were here the whole time. So the way I describe it is this. We have a big bin full of shoes, right? And the shoes are from all these different countries, right? They're culturally specific shoes. And for years and years and years, white actors have been pulling whatever shoe they want out of the bin. And the actors whose shoes they actually belong to haven't even been able to approach the bin. They can't even get their own shoes out. Right now, what's happening is the entertainment industry is saying, wait, wait, give those shoes back. Let the person who's Korean wear the Korean shoes, etc. Give them their own authentic shoes back. And we're claiming them and saying, oh my God, I get to be me. But over time, we all want to be able to have a shoe bin that we can draw from. A Korean actor should not be only playing Korean characters and Japanese characters. I mean, they should be playing all Asian characters, I think, in the long run. But right now, we are in what I consider the healing beat. It's a restoration of people's rights back to them. And when those actors and cultures are ready to put their shoes back in the bin, and when they're allowed to draw from the bin the American shoes they've been barred from drawing from, then we'll have a world where those things are much more open. Okay, we can go in that direction. But no marginalized actor, POC actor, LGBTQ actor wants to be only playing inside that box, but they haven't even been able to get inside that box for a while. Well, since forever, really.
What kinds of roles would you not take?
I think if something especially is first person, and it's from specifically like an Asian culture or even a Russian culture, we have actors who can do that. I mean, think about African Americans are 12% of the population. That's it, 12%. So how many white actors have grown up around black families? It's only going to be a handful because we've been living with segregation. We're still living with segregation, but I'm acknowledging when and where would most white actors in our country have extended time with black families and friends? But think about it from the other side. We're only 12% of the population. Every room we go into, everywhere we go, we're surrounded by a culture that's defined by white culture. We either grow up in it and we know it like the back of our hand, or if we don't and we grow up, let's say, more of a specifically black neighborhood that's separate, as we go along and go into college and go into jobs, we have to know the dominant culture to survive. But that's not true for white actors. And I've met several who, they have grown up around black folks, but it is a thorny kind of a thing right now. And I think we'll get through it because we are beginning to realize that we have to respect that there are cultural differences. I do not expect to be cast in Crazy Rich Asians, you know, the audio drama. There are too many things that I don't know from an insider view.
Yeah, yeah.
I was doing ADR, which is additional dialogue recording.
Mm-hmm.
I used to do that a lot in New York. And we were dubbing a film, and we were doing a scene where everybody in the room was a black guy, and it was a bachelor party, so I'm the only woman in the room because I'm voicing the two women. But one of the guys in the loop group was a white guy who's like cooled down, you know, he's got lots of black friends. He's just kind of like got that coolness and that urban coolness. And the guy, two guys get in a fight, and we have to improv on the mic. And he said, "Whoa, whoa, somebody call the cops." And every black man in that room stopped their improv and just looked over at him like, no, that's not what would happen.
You're instantly out of character.
Well, it's because he didn't know
yes.
that if a group of black men are in a hotel room having a bachelor party and they call the police,
yes.
chances are somebody's going to walk out wounded.
Yeah.
And that's a best case scenario. But he didn't know that. And so they were all sort of shocked into silence for a second. And the poor guy, he was like, what? What? He had no idea why it wasn't appropriate.
Yeah.
And so you need somebody with that kind of just like insider knowledge when you're doing cultural work. And I will say this. I narrate, or I've been doing this for so long, and I do it so often during the week, that I live in a state of emotional openness that can be a little frightening to exist in that state of no defenses. I have to make sure that the people around me and my friends and thank God for my husband, Ty, they understand that I just live in a very vulnerable state day in and day out.
You're channeling all of the stories that you tell.
I need to be open enough as a human to let whatever that author put in there register and then bounce back out.
Yeah. Robin Miles, thank you so much.
I had a really good time. Thank you for having me.
Me too. Me too. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You can read more from Daniel Gross on Robin Miles and her work at newyorker.com. She's the narrator of hundreds of audiobooks, and here she is reading from Jacqueline Woodson's Another Brooklyn.
For a long time, my mother wasn't dead yet. Mine could have been a more tragic story. My father could have given in to the bottle or the needle or a woman and left my brother and me to care for ourselves, or worse, in the care of New York City Children's Services, where my father said there was seldom a happy ending. But this didn't happen. I know now that what is tragic isn't the moment. It is the memory.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. As the year comes to an end, we've been hearing each week from the writer Susan Orlean and selections from her obit column, Afterward. Now, one thing about Susan, she's kind of an animal nut. In fact, her last book was a collection called simply On Animals. And she has that in common with her subject today, a Texas man named Eugene DeLeon.
Rattlesnakes give most people the creeps. But there is a subset of people who find them inviting. Eugene DeLeon was frequently photographed cozying up with and even smooching rattlesnakes. He had no fear of them at all. His interest started early. His father, a security guard in the Texas oil fields, used to while away his shift catching snakes that wriggled by his post and would bring them home for his children to admire. The passion for snakes stuck with DeLeon. He was crazy for them, his daughter Blanca Trevino told me recently. Very crazy. After studying at Coastal Bend College, DeLeon, who worked in the oil fields like his father, founded Snakebusters Snake Handlers, an all-purpose snake enterprise. Snakes in your basement? No problem. Call Snakebusters. Need snake blood for a folk remedy for cancer? Snakebusters can accommodate. The brushy fields around DeLeon's home in Freer, Texas, are prime rattler territory. The snakes found their way onto playgrounds and into shopping centers and living rooms all the time. DeLeon, who was also a volunteer firefighter and civic-minded in every way, liked that he was doing something helpful in town. Trevino, his daughter, said that she would have been happy to kiss those snakes goodbye. But as soon as DeLeon's son, Eugene Jr., was old enough, he joined Snakebusters too, marking the start of a third generation of DeLeon snake fans. DeLeon's wife, Simona, however, was not an enthusiast of the whole venomous reptile thing. During the past few years, she had pressed him to hang it up, but he couldn't be budged. The capstone of every year for the Snakebusters was the Freer Rattlesnake Roundup, a three-day slithering creature festival held each spring. The roundup includes exhibitions and a pageant and competition to be named the year's rattlesnake royalty. DeLeon was in his glory there, demonstrating his rattlers and selling snakeskin doodads and rattlesnake meat. It really does taste like chicken, Trevino said. If you cook it right, it's delicious. It might surprise you to know that, as terrifying as rattlesnakes are, only a small number of people are killed by them each year. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in the United States, between 7,000 and 8,000 people are bitten annually by venomous snakes, but on average, there are only 5 fatalities. Among the unlucky ones when it comes to venomous snakes are researchers who must handle them frequently and get bitten more than once. Historically, quite a few rattlesnake victims have been members of Christian sects who believe that holding a snake in your bare hands is called for in the Bible. Specifically, Mark chapter 16, verse 18. It's considered a demonstration of religious faith, and if they are bitten, they count on divine intervention rather than medical help. The practice has killed or injured so many people that it is now illegal in several states. On occasion, someone will sit on a rattlesnake hidden in the brush, or surprise one in a pumpkin patch and not get medical treatment quickly enough. Usually, though, rattlesnakes have a live-and-let-live attitude and are far more likely to wriggle away from humans than to hunt them down and kill them. But being a snake buster required a lot of face time with rattlers, and the risk was consequently amplified. 4 years ago, at the rattlesnake roundup, Eugene Jr. was bitten and ended up having to have a thumb amputated. De Leon himself had also been bitten in the past. In recent years, De Leon began to mull over whether he ought to retire or at least cut back a bit. But when his wife Simona died last year, he was crushed. And according to Trevino, keeping busy with the snakes was what kept him alive. According to his sister Monica, though, De Leon had decided that perhaps this year's rattlesnake roundup would be his last. It would be his 20th appearance, so maybe the fact that it was a round number made it seem fitting. Everything was going as planned, until one of his demonstrations. No one is quite sure what happened, but the large rattler he was holding squirmed out of his hands and repeatedly bit him on the shoulder and back. He was helicoptered to Corpus Christi for intensive care, but he succumbed to the bites. Trevino believes that he wouldn't hold a grudge against the snake, and that if he had to do it again, even knowing the risks, he'd still be handling them. Wherever he is now, she said, he's doing the same thing.
Susan Orlean, her essay, A Man Who Loved Rattlesnakes, comes from her column, Afterword. You can find it at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick. Thanks so much for listening today. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Toon Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Ngofen Mputubwele,
along with Adam Howard, Jeffrey Masters, and Max Bolton. And we had assistance from Mike Kutchman, Meher Bhatia, and James Napoli.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.